Session number 915.
Colonel Lindsay, Real One. Just to set the scene, Colonel, could you tell me a little bit about your personal background and the circumstances under which you came to join the Army?
Well, I joined the Army because I liked horses rather than soldiering as such. And there was nowhere then to be taught how to ride, except for the army, with no civilian things or whatever. And really, that's why I joined. And my father was a 70G, and Colonel Chappell, my godfather, and he was commanding the KDGs then, when the war shot, so that's why I went.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever consider an alternative arm of the service to the cavalry?
No. No, it was a horse I loved. It wasn't the service I liked much.
Yeah. To someone of my generation, to go in for a soldiering career, or to have to accept a soldiering career primarily through your interest in horses, seems like rather an extreme recourse. I mean, I was wondering if you couldn't have satisfied your interest in horses without going to such an apparently drastic extreme of joining us.
Well, I liked earning my living, which I thought it was, and doing the thing I liked doing. And I was quite happy to go into battle doing that.
How typical a motive was love of horses for the average cavalry officer? Was it commonplace, a commonplace reason for joining?
Well, I think the majority did it, yes. There were a lot of one who couldn't understand why they joined. But I think that was probably basically the thing, really.
Now, you joined the King's Dragoons Guards at Aldershot in 1929. Did your experiences at Aldershot proved to be as agreeable a life as you had hoped for when you joined?
Well, there were bloody moments about everything. You see, when I was at Sandhurst, everybody had to have riding lessons, and I found that the sergeant majors, drill sergeants, the ones who were the horsed, were twice as human and the guards, some majors and people, who were absolutely inhuman to my mind, but probably they might have had a milk of human kindness somewhere, and not apparent. Well, it was very apparent with the horse, the instructors. And the whole way through with horses, even then, it seemed to be a much more human approach to life than the other kind of, especially the foot soldiers.
Tell me in a little bit of detail the kind of initial period of training, about the initial period of training at Aldershot, the kind of pattern of training and routine day-to-day life. Yes, but I'd like you to tell me.
Well, I would like to tell you, it's written down quite well, clearly, but the daily routine was reveille at 6 o'clock, which was sounded by the trumpeter. Then you were watered and fed the horses. Then you did your ablutions. Then you had breakfast. Then at 8:30, riding school, or whatever training going on. And then 11 o'clock. That we went on for 9:30, and then 11 o'clock came stables, where everybody attended, and usually the young officer joining had to do the same as a trooper, groom as well as everything else. And then the squadron leader passed the horses, whether groomed or not, after the troop leader, then watered and fed, and then lunch. And after lunch, 2 o'clock, roughly, well, exactly, foot drill or other musketry or what you will, till 4:30. I mean, they had education. Some of the chaps couldn't read or write when they joined. And
some of the other ranks, you mean?
Yes, other ranks. Mm. And then water and feed it fed again, 4:30. Then
how competent a horseman were you when you joined the cavalry?
Well, I was probably better than some, because only by good luck. I didn't know how to jump a horse over a fence, which I went center. But there's a thing called the saddle you competed for at Sandhurst, and I became second or third in that. So I was probably better than average, really. Mm. I think. Or someone better than average, always.
I think you're being modest, because I've heard of your reputation as a horseman from General Younger and Cornel McKirkadale. But for an experienced rider, as you would have been, quite an experienced rider when you went to Aldershot, did you find riding school was something you could take very easily in your stride, or was it learning to ride in a rather different kind of way than you'd previously experienced?
No, it was probably easier for me than it was for most, but the saddles were so bloody uncomfortable, those army saddles, for what you had to do. And I could never vault, and you always had to vault on and off at the move, on the move. And that was absolute hell, because I'm frightfully bad at it. Always have been. I'm no gymnast. And I remember going round, we were taken by a sergeant, Callum, I think he was, Callum. And luckily it was a misty day, and when we had to vault, I waited to my turn, the mist almost hid me, because I'm very bad at that. But otherwise, fairly simple. But you had to learn the sword as well, dummy thrusting.
Tell me about the sort of exercises that you were progressively trained through at riding school at Aldershot as a recruit officer, as a relatively new recruit.
Well, the whole thing about learning to ride is you've got to educate the muscles. That's really the thing. You can't do it until the muscles are shaped right. And Krishna bouncing round till you set down the saddle. And you did it to the Eton boating song sometimes. Bump, bump together, till our boozies are blue from blue, or something like that. No, I think some other ranks, 60 lessons, could be passed out, and they were top-class horsemen. It was in every skill at arms as well as riding. Mm.
So there
was at least 60 lessons, an hour and a half each. But it was 120 to 80, the average. Depends on sickness, leave, and so on.
So the initial exercises you did at riding school were directed towards improving your muscular condition.
Yes, something up.
Yes. Well, what kind of exercises did they use for that purpose?
Well, quit and cross your stirrups.
Sorry?
Quit and cross your stirrups.
I'm terribly ignorant. Don't assume that I know anything and treat me like an idiot in the answers.
Well, you have a pair of stirrup bands to support yourself in the saddle rather than without. And if you can't put your feet in the stirrup arm, you rest your fork in the saddle with all your weight on top. So you quit and cross your stirrups, bounce round, trying to slide your arse backside underneath you the whole time to supple up the loins. And having got that suppled up, well, that you went on for about 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, pretty exhausted, you'd be wobbling off. So you walk and take your stirrups, was the order. You took your stirrup, and then you had to use your legs to go forward and ease your reins. And you had to be taught that harmony of aids. If you pull the reins too much, you'd rein back, sufficient to the day and the day thereof. and you squeeze the legs, you ease the reins. And when you want to trot, you do it the same, sitting down the backside. You have to be taught that. You don't want to go fucking the front arch, the expression was. Don't go fucking the front arch. You sit back behind it. You had to learn the trumpet calls, and not easy to remember those.
Why not?
Well, because if you're not musical, and very awkward sometimes, but the troopers used to learn it by putting him to rhymes, like the thing for trotting. Let's get this right. The order for the trumpeter signing the trot, he got to learn it by arseholes bobbing up and down. And he really sounded like arseholes bobbing up and down the trumpet call.
Uh-huh.
So they meant he was a trot, rising. You rose up, rising at the trot. You rise in the... get your backside off the saddle so you don't... sitting down, you don't bump all the time.
Yes.
So it's arseholes rising up and down.
I see, and the trumpet call sounded like that. Onomatopoeic.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that's how... took a bit of learning. Then you had to riding school again. You had to learn how to dismount with your rifle. And the led horse is taken away by one man. One rider took three away while you dismounted. And you taught the sword by a dummy, which you had to thrust at in an appropriate way. If you don't turn the edge up, it wouldn't go in properly. That's a game muscle to get your forearm strong.
And apart from the sword, what other weapons were involved in the skillet arms exercises?
Well, only the sword and the rifle. Sword, really, passing out, because that was the difficult bit.
Were there any other exercises with the sword apart from dummy thrusting?
Well, you did it on the parade ground too. You got into riding position, you're bending your legs, knee. You've never been on a horse?
Oh, a few times, but very few. I'm no sort of horseman. What was much of the training? Made competitive so that, you know, you had individuals competing with each other and squadrons competing with each other, troops competing with each other?
Well, only in the horse, when you had a horse show once a year, then there was all that went on.
That was a yearly event, was it?
Yeah.
What were they like? Tell me about them.
Well, it was best trained remount, that it was a horse coming up to be half-trained horse. There were classes for a remount, just been backed, so on. And then there were best trained troop horse. It's kind of the dressage, I think, now. And then there was jumping, show jumping. And there was tent pegging.
What's that?
Well, you know Lance, and, well, you had to gallop and take a peg driven in the ground at the gallop. And you had to have the right position doing it. And there it was marked whether you took the peg and whether your position was correct. And that was open to all ranks. So most of the things were open to all ranks.
So you would have commissioned and non-commissioned ranks competing directly with each other?
Oh, yes. But there were, of course, juniors and seniors and so on, and there was obviously officers thing and corporal competition and sergeant competition. But it's all so long ago.
You went to the equitation school at Whedon in 1936.
Yeah.
After some 7 years in the regiment. Why was it necessary after 7 years in the regiment to go to an equitation school? Did you learn a different kind of riding at Whedon?
Didn't I go before that? I think I went before, I was very lucky to go as well as I did.
Yes.
Because there were no other, you were only allowed probably two vacancies in about 3 years, every regiment.
Yes.
And there was no one in my KDGs who was particularly wanted to go or good enough. And so I was very luckily selected, much earlier age than I normally would have gone.
And how did the training you got at Whedon differ from the training you'd already received with the KDG?
Well, it was far more... The riding was your be and end all, almost. And you know, everything you did was riding, no discipline as such. And, you had three separate horses given you to train yourself. One a trained horse, which you had to do what you did in the regiment, riding school, exercising, so on and so forth. But that was far more intense.
So it was the same kinds of things, more of them.
That's right.
Could you tell me in a little more detail exactly how it was more intensive, in what kinds of ways? Give me some examples.
Well, it was more intense in fact that your instructor was a very highly skilled one, and he knew how to work your whole time. And otherwise, you'd done a bit of mental training. Very unlikely to have anybody with a skilled instructor as such. And you were possibly put through it more thoroughly because you had to be able to pass out as expert as possible, not only taking a ride, instructing yourself, but you were certainly put through it more because you're more individual, I think.
Yes. Exactly how were you put through it, though?
Well, you did longer periods without stirrups, and you had did better, more thorough jumps. You were put down the big lane, for instance, jumping lane, without stirrups and folded arm. You had to take your saddle off while you were doing it. And that way was more thorough. And possibly you only had blanket rides too.
What's a blanket ride?
Well, you had a blanket instead of a saddle. Just strapped on, blanket.
How did they first treat you when you arrived at Whedon? Did they treat you as cavalry officers who were already very proficient riders, or did they...
Well, you're taught as a beginner.
You're taught as a beginner?
Yes. Well, put through it like you were put through a beginner. Mm-hmm. But you weren't quite so gently treated as a beginner, because the great thing about teaching riding is not to let anybody fall off to start with, ever. You only fell off when you thought you knew. So it didn't put you off for that reason, ever. Rather better than the old-fashioned way, when how many times you fell off. And the riding master cracked the whip, make you fall off, I think, of course, but that wasn't so. You had to be taught how to teach without giving anybody a fall. Then you had to half-train, which was a remount from the previous term. You had to bring that up to pass that out as a fully trained horse. And then the remount, which was unbacked, you had to train it to be sufficient to be a half-trained when you left. So you hand that on to the next people coming.
I see. During this initial period of your service with the KDG, when you're at Aldershot, What was the sort of pattern of social and recreational life? What kinds of things did you spend your spare time doing?
Well, if you had enough money, because you were expected to have a, officers were expected to have a couple of polo ponies anyway, the first thing, if you didn't have that, in addition, you was much like to have had a racehorse as well. But you couldn't, many couldn't afford that. So you were lucky if you had £5 pocket money, because you had to pay a mess bill, tailor's bill, which was accumulating, because you couldn't pay it all at once. You had to buy yourself your outfit, and your allowance was infinitesimal, and you only got about 10 bob a day. And you had to pay your forage bill with that, and your mess bill with that. So it didn't leave many much money. So your social activities were very cramped. If you were from Aldershot, you went up to town, well, you had to be properly dressed and so on and so forth. And that was about once a month, if you could afford that. But you played, well, you played football, soccer, squash. There were plenty of games to play. And in the summer, you expected to play polo, which was 3 days a week, for now a couple of hours in the afternoon. And the show jumping was really the exquisite of the NCO. Officer wasn't supposed to take a good show jumper and do it himself. There were exceptions, of course, like Colonel Joe Dudgeon, who had sea count, and another gentleman called Crossley, he went in for it, but there were two only exceptional.
So show jumping was the province of NCOs and other ranks, wasn't it?
That was right in the KDGs anyway. Mm. Yes. And I think by and large throughout.
These expenses you had to meet, the various ones you've just described, was your pay sufficient to cover them?
No. No, one had to have a lance, and that varied from £100 to £500 a year in those days. But after the war, General Dick McCreary said, who was a 12th Lancer, said if anybody had to have any lance at all, he'd stop it. So no one was ever allowed to be officially given a lance. He had to live on his pay.
The allowance would be from private your private income.
Your
perhaps
private
allowance from your father.
Allowance from your father.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty costly thing to be a cavalry officer during
Well, pretty costly thing to be an officer to any regiment, I think, in a way. But if you wanted to do anything at all.
But more so in the cavalry regiments.
More so in the cavalry regiments,
yes. Yes. And what scale of private income was necessary in order to be able to afford to be an officer in the KDG?
Well, I reckon you couldn't join unless you had 150 to 200, the minimum, a year. 500, you're well off. You're all right. I mean, you're all right. You weren't a millionaire, all right, but it was enough. 500.
And was there much variation in the costliness of belonging to various cavalry regiments?
Yes, oh yes. I don't like to mention names of what regiments, but certainly regiments were pretty expensive, like the 10th Hussars, for instance. And it varied a lot. KDGs were what we'd call a poor regiment. I never had a car. I couldn't afford a car for... I had a motorbike, the first thing I had, and I couldn't afford a car for a war, after war. Even then, it was different. Mm.
Exactly what was it that made some cavalry regiments more expensive than others?
Either they were wealthier people, or the tradition was such that you had to have this and had to have that.
What sort of this and that?
Well, this and that being racehorses, chiefly. You had to ride in races, I think, was really... And you had to have probably more better class ponies, polo ponies. I think that was really the only excess expense you had to have. You didn't have to do it anywhere else, I don't think. I'm sure you didn't. But I know some regiments were very much more too expensive.
Which were the ones that were reputed to be the most expensive?
Well, I said the 10th Hussars was one that comes to my mind.
Mm-hmm. What about the others? I mean, what about the Greys, for example?
Well, you better ask Humphrey Guinness about the Greys.
Mm.
He knows.
Mm.
I don't really know. I wouldn't like to say like this.
Yes.
Just some regiments were more expensive than others, well known.
Yes, yes, yes. During that initial period in England from 1929 to 1932, part of the annual training presumably was annual exercises.
Yes.
Did those bring you into contact with any other arms?
Oh yes, gunners, infantry, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yes,
Did they bring you into contact with any tank corps units?
Only in opposition.
Can you remember any exercises in which you were in opposition to tank corps units and
yes,
tell me a bit about some of your experience?
Any details that would be any use, really.
Mm-hmm.
I know definitely several. But I can't really remember anything.
Okay. You went to Egypt with the regiment in 1932. How did you enjoy life in Egypt after your 3 years in the UK?
Oh, very much so. I loved it.
What kind of things did you like about
the
life?
Well, mind you, I was in a very good position being riding master. You had to get your work done early in the morning, not as early when in India, but because of the heat. And we were in Abbasir, the barracks, which led on to the desert. And then the Egyptians across the road, they all had stallion. And cricket was grand. Sport was first class. I mean, and swimming, if you like swimming. And Cairo was a hive of delight for those who wanted it.
In what kinds of ways?
Well, chiefly wine, women, and song. And it used to be known as all the women came out to get wives there.
To get husbands?
Yeah. Husband, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can't remember the well-known name that used to come out. One of our officers, Captain Radford by the name then, he got married. A lot of people got married. Colonel Lowther got married. The Colonel Radford, he got engaged by going back on the ship together. They were both seasick. But he got married that way. But they all come out as looking for a husband.
Mm-hmm.
Don't say they all come out, but most of them.
Did the pattern of individual and regimental training in Egypt have any differences with the pattern that you had become familiar with in England?
No, exactly the same, really, the pattern, exactly the same.
No differences at all?
No, except the conditions of the climate.
Mm-hmm.
No, there was no difference, except, of course, the stables were away from the barracks. In Aldershot, you slept above the stables. The conditions of living were slightly different, but the pattern of training was the same.
Yes. Did the regiment have any operational tasks to perform during that period in Egypt?
No, not active service, no, there wasn't any. But manoeuvres took the same pattern, but the different conditions again, you know, desert, water, supply systems different. There was also tanks and armored cars.